bring the meeting of the Health, Education, and Social Services meeting together on today, February 6th, and it is about 2.5 minutes after 3. So today I welcome all of you here. Thank you for being here. And go down the committee. The members that are present are Representative Gatto, Representative Hines, Representative Seaton, and Representative Sitna, and myself, Representative Wilson. And today we are going to, we have two overviews today. One is the overview on the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And the second one really is an overview of the update from the Mental Health Trust Authority. So we'll start out with our overview on the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities first. And we have five of them with us today. One is the director, Sarah Brinkley, and she's just going to be, I think she's here for moral support for the rest of them. But anyway, Leonard Abel is the program administrator for mental health services. Then there's David Maltman, program administrator for developmental disabilities. Ronald Burns, director of API. And Dan Wigman, director of quality assurance for the division. So I think, Leonard Abel, you were going to go up and come up and speak first. Just come forward and for the members of the committee, this is under tab one of your binder. Always bring your binders, and we hopefully try to have them in and everything in order. So under tab one, and Mr. Abel, would you go ahead and proceed?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leonard Abel, and she said, as the chair said, I'm the Community Mental Health Services Program Administrator. One of the first things I wanted to talk to you about is this this sheet, which is should be the top sheet. It talks about the various influences that the division has to respond to, the various sources of information or concern. First off, I think I need to say that does not mean that we spend all of our time blowing bubbles, but there are a lot of bubbles here. I'll try to walk you through those. In the center, the big old you see is our division, and it's broken out into four major sections. There's mental health, which I head, safety and quality assurance, head by Dan Wigman, developmental disabilities, David Maltman, and admin and support, which is Sarah Brinkley when she's not being acting director. At the extreme right of that oval, you see Alaska Psychiatric Institute, API. Those are the main operations of our division. Where we get all of our directions, first in the center of that, the administration, the governor, from the governor through the commissioner, the overall vision, the mission for our department, and ultimately our division. From our planning boards, or the right hand side is the Alaska Mental Health Board, Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. They developed the plan for mental health and for developmental disabilities. They interact with the Trust Authority, which basically approves those plans and provides recommendations for the funding. The legislature sets priorities by statute, provide the statutes governing our policy and the way we deliver services. Also, the federal government gives us directions either through restrictions on the grants that we get or federal statutes. Another major driver I want to point out on the extreme left of that center oval is our ADA integration project. We're actually implementing this year integrated alcohol and mental health services. We're actually in this for a sample of our mental health grantees and alcohol grantees. We're actually doing a single grant, allowing a single treatment plan, a single site review, and a truly integrated services for the first time. Okay, also, we respond.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, but I want, for the record, want to note that Representative Capson has joined us. Sorry, Mr. Abel, go ahead.
Okay, then below that central oval, we have things that I deal with. There's 33 community mental health centers, 22 other specialty mental health agencies, and 15 Alaska Youth Initiative vendors. We have to deal individually with all of those providers, and then there is an association that ACSMA is Alaska Community Mental Health Services Association, which has 44 members, and then there's Association of Rural Providers that we deal with specifically around rural issues. On the far right of that is the Developmental Disabilities, their provider group, 32 grantees with 59 grants. In the center is Assisted Living Homes, which provide services to both mental health and developmental disabilities consumers. There's over 200 of those homes. And finally, but really, truly not least, is the mental health consumers, family members, and advocates, and developmental disabilities consumer and advocates. Before I get into what mental health does specifically in way of services, I point out that, if you go back to the central oval in this bubble chart, there's 21 mental health staff. One of those is me, and we have four major regional coordinators who provide grant management, technical assistance. But also, I think very important in there is a mother of a mentally ill son who went through the entire child system, then the adult system, and is now employed by us as a consumer family advocate. She drives. She makes sure that both on mental health and DD that we can keep it consumer focused, and it's a key member of our staff. Okay, mental health. And as soon as I'm done, then David will walk you through DD and carry on. The way mental health is structured, it's a holdover from the old days of federal grants. The entire state is in somebody's catchment area, divided up into 32 of those catchment areas, so that somebody is responsible for every Alaskan, for their mental health needs, their emergency needs. And where that primarily has its effect is in our 24-hour emergency service. So every person knows that there's somebody to turn to if you've got a crisis, and respond 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's our top priority program. Immediately below that in priority is our program for seriously mentally ill adults. And the seriously mentally ill includes people with illnesses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, used to be known as manic depressive disorder, those people with very serious, very disabling mental illnesses. For 04, we're making some changes that particular program is picking up another large group of people that have disabling but non-psychotic mental disorders. These are serious conditions like anorexia nervosa, which is a life-threatening eating disorder, persons with very disabling personality disorders, and also what new emphasis for us coming up in 04 is persons with emotional and cognitive and behavioral problems related to organic conditions, particularly for us is organic brain disorder, traumatic brain disorder. We've got a federal grant right now to do planning, and we're, I think, going to hear very soon, we've got a big grant to do treatment implementation. So this is brand new focus for us. It's been a very underserved population.
Good time to at least let the record show that Representative Wolf has joined us. Go ahead.
All right. With those two, when we combine those two programs, we'll be serving somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,000 adults that are seriously mentally ill or in that serious but non-psychotic conditions. We've been calling those severely emotionally disturbed adults. Our of equal priority, our services to severely emotionally disturbed youth, we're currently serving about 3,800 in two separate programs. The Alaska Youth Initiative, which we moved to a fee-for-service program 2 years ago, and then a basic grant-supported program for the rest of the kids. We're looking at 04 moving that entire project over to the fee-for-service, be a single daily payment based on level of care determination like AYI. And I think we can tie the two programs that have been actually historically very separate into a single unified program that'll far better serve the kids. We found with AYI, and we made the shift, we served more kids at a lower cost, and I'm anticipating the same thing happening with the rest of the system.
Mr. Abel, when you use the acronyms, not everyone is familiar with them, so if you would just go ahead and tell us what the whole name is.
AYI, Alaska Youth Initiative, SED, Severely Emotionally Disturbed Kids. We get so tied up, and we're used to talking with each other, that I apologize for that. General community mental health is our has been our lowest priority program, but it's something that I think benefits Alaskans, that people that have non-disabling, really usually non-life-threatening kinds of condition, it's very good to have the mental health services, but it doesn't reach the priority level of the other populations that I talked about. And what we're looking at for 04 is to basically terminate that particular program. So we put all of our resources into the other populations. And as you look at the document, the summary that we passed out to you, it talks about that's where those roughly 2,500 severely emotionally disturbed adults have been residing, and we're going to move those people into the program with the severely mentally ill adults. The other program that we've been running for some time, that we've also been expanding, is our designated evaluation treatment program. We have it's actually a fairly small pot of money, but we have been paying kind of a payer of last resort for indigent people in local community hospitals. It's had a couple of benefits. It helps keep or slow some of the flow into API, and it also allows people to get served brief hospitalization a lot closer to home, and that's probably a greater benefit in terms of clinical services to people. We now there's 15 hospitals that we have agreements with currently, and we have a program come in. If they are indigent, they can apply for us to pay the services. We pay the doctor bill, we pay the hospital bill, and transportation. Last year, I think we served 930 people in the program, which is by far the highest number that we've served before. Traditionally, it was running about half that number. So basically, all I've got about mental health. Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Abel, do you have any idea of why that was such an increase last year?
A couple of things. We went from about nine hospitals to 15, because we've really been pushing this, and we provide a lot of transportation, particularly in Anchorage, moving them around from the single point of entry to API, and both of those factors.
Thank you, Representative Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back up here on the
on your first sheet, you've got State of Alaska provides competitive grant funding to 33 local nonprofit providers to run community mental health centers. Are you including in there Providence Hospital? Is that, or is this just community mental health centers?
Through the chair, Representative Hines, that does not include Providence Hospital. That's strictly the community mental health center.
Thank you. Any other members have any questions before we move on? All right, and that, I think, then is David Maltman next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is David Maltman, and I'm the Developmental Disability Program Administrator in the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'd like to tell you a little bit about who's regarded as having a developmental disability, and something about the services they receive and how we administer those services. A developmental disability is a severe, chronic, disabling condition that's usually present at birth or at in the early stages of life, certainly before the age of 22, that results in a substantial limitation in the person's ability to function in their community. They often require a sequential lifelong supports throughout their lives. And the types of disabilities that are could be considered developmental disabilities are mental retardation, cerebral palsy, autism, sometimes fetal alcohol syndrome, and sometimes young persons with mental illness can be considered to have a developmental disability. It's a definition in statute that's not by diagnostic condition. It's a functional definition. So we do an assessment of each person's ability compared to others that function in this, their communities well. There are about 12 to 13,000 Alaskans that we estimate have developmental disabilities. There's a national prevalence statistic that we use of 1.8% of the population would have a developmental disability. And you apply that to Alaska's population in general, and you arrive at a figure between 12 and 13,000 people. The role of the state program is to determine eligibility and to administer services in two ways. We administer about 59 different grants for different kinds of services through 39 different kinds of organizations, generally nonprofit organizations. And in your communities, you know their names of Community Connection, Matsu Services for Children, also called CELS, Frontier Community Services, HOPE, Community Services, the ARC, Assets, and Catholic Social Services, DD Pride, and Bethel Community Services are some of the names of the grantees. The services that they deliver are specialized and require a certain level of expertise to deal with people with developmental disabilities who often have different behaviors than others, or health conditions, or certain needs for supports that other people may not have. And this is a unique nature of developmental disability services. Many states have provided this service through an institutional setting, and I think advocates and people with disabilities in Alaska are always proud to say that Alaska ranks last in what you spend on developmental disability services in institutions. Alaska has a community system of services. And again, we administer those services through grants to local nonprofit organizations. The other way that we administer services is through two Medicaid waivers, and it's an important task for us, again, to determine eligibility, make sure that a person has an appropriate plan of care, and we prior authorize the services that people receive. And then the organizations that deliver the services are allowed to bill for those services. The current issues we face in developmental disabilities have to do with the need to maintain a waiting list and manage the waiting list so that it moves at a reasonable pace. so that we move eligible individuals off the waiting list into services as quickly as we can, given the resources that are provided, both through about $20 million in community developmental disability grants and about $70 million in Medicaid waivers. There's another waiver that we administer, and it's not specifically for children with developmental disabilities, but for children that have complex medical conditions who require the need for medical technology to sustain their life. This is a separate waiver that we administer. The other issue that's present across our state in our particular business and in others is the workforce development issues. We're trying to deliver these services in the person's home or in their community, and the number of people available to do that work, their qualifications, are really providing limits to what we can do in every community. In addition to that, the other issue we face is we've gone through a decade of implementing these two waivers that I mentioned, and we had to develop the infrastructure in that decade to deliver community services and to demonstrate that this model of community services was going to work for people in the state. We're at a point now where we're having to apply cost containments so that we can still expand, but within the limits of limits of appropriation. Those are the three major issues I think we face in developmental disabilities. And if I can answer any questions, I'd be very glad to do that.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question here on Harborview.
Mm-hmm.
When it was closed, I know it's very difficult sometimes on the families to care for developmental, well, it depends on the range, but sometimes mm-hmm. it can get very hard.
Yes.
Were the families in favor of closing Harborview?
Through the chair? Yes, ma'am. Well, I think it varies. And I think the task for the developmental disability program at that time was to convince those families who had residents at Harborview that services could be sustained over time, could be as stable as what people thought the services at Harborview were, and could be delivered with the quality with which the services at Harborview were provided. And again, our task over the last decade has been to demonstrate that. From what we know, by talking to those families, now that they've moved into the community, they are very pleased. Although there are still issues because we're limited in terms of the workforce, but in general, they believe that the quality of life is better. We know that in the aggregate, the services are cheaper, so we're able to deliver more services to people, and the families seem to be pleased. And there are several studies to demonstrate this, that where we've actually interviewed the families who had residents at Harborview, have talked with them now about their community placements.
Thank you. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did mention that Alaska was last in funding of developmental disabilities. Am I correct?
Well, in institutional settings.
How do we rank in the states for the number that we have relative to our population?
The per capita in the community? I'll have to get a precise answer for you because there's a study of states just on that issue of how much money goes into the community versus the institution. But I would expect to find us in the mid-range of what's being done across the other states.
Clarify for me the words you use, in the community versus, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm dealing with numbers in the state mm-hmm. or numbers in all the communities in the state, and is that different?
When I refer to the community, the services are in the community. We're talking about services all across the state that are provided in a person's community and in their home, as opposed to a facility which exists in a single community like Valdez, where Harborview was.
Somehow
it's not
that
a good answer.
No, it did not clarify it for me.
Let's try it again.
Somehow Valdez is different, their community, because there's a single community, is different than any other community?
The facility at Harborview does not serve people with developmental disabilities since November of 1997. Instead, the legislature and past administrations have pursued a model of services to people with developmental disabilities that is a community model, as opposed to developing other state-run facilities.
Representative Wolf.
Yeah, Madam Chair, can you clarify the dollar amount range that for a Medicaid waiver for an individual?
Madam Chair, the average cost today for a Medicaid waiver is about $60,000, $62,000, I think, is the figure that we're using with Medicaid. And, of course, this is an average. Services that an individual would receive vary a great deal depending on their level of need, their choices that they make in terms of if they choose to live in a home or in a supported apartment setting. There's various kinds of supports that we render. The supports really are tailored to meet the needs of the individual as opposed to standard category of services. And we find that this provides not only consumers with better service, but it better meets the need, and you don't over staff a program, or you don't over resource a certain service. The $62,000 generally will provide those in-home supports that a person would need to live in the community, develop their capacity for independence, and be able to participate in their community as much as possible. The institutional costs at the time that the state closed Harborview were about, as I recall, over $130,000 a year. And one of the elements in administering the waiver is you have to keep the community costs in a neutral situation with the cost of providing services to that individual in an institution. So in general, community services are less expensive and often provide a higher quality of service because they're tailored to the needs of the individual.
Question?
Follow up, Representative Lyons.
Wolf. That's okay. I was late. I apologize. So the cost can range between $140,000 to zero, depending on the need. Okay. You've answered a personal question, and I very, very greatly appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. If there's more information about how plans are developed and how we determine what kinds of services a person might need, I'd be glad to talk with you about that.
I appreciate that.
Representative Capsman. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be clear on one of your statements. You said that Alaska ranked one of the lowest states in the union for spending in institutional services. And what I'm hearing is that you're not complaining that we're not necessarily devoting enough money to institutional care, but instead highlighting that we don't put people with schizophrenia and bipolar disease, we don't lock them up. They remain in our communities, whether it be Platinum or Bethel or Anchorage or Valdez, and we care for them in a natural setting.
Well, first, Madam Chair, I'd just like to clarify. We can say this a number of ways. I think generally advocates are pleased that Alaska does not operate a state facility for people with developmental disabilities. Other states do. And so by the fact of Alaska not having a state facility, we rank last and expenditures in an institutional setting. Now, I would distinguish in your question a bit in that there are different facilities for people with mental illness, and Leonard Abel can talk about them, and Randall's going to talk about the Alaska Psychiatric Facility.
Okay.
But for people with developmental disabilities, our model of service is in the community, in the person's home.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just under here where you've got what kind of services for DDs and their family, you've got respite care, and yet this is community services. How do you provide respite care in different communities other than, say, the crisis center at Providence?
Well, local nonprofit organizations manage that service. We pay for that service either through grants specifically for respite care, or they are able to become a Medicaid provider and bill for that service through that system. But respite care is an in-home service. Respite care is relief of the caregiver so that they might continue to deliver that care in the home. So it can be, it's really the service that's most requested by families. And it's a service that we feel we can render in every community in Alaska using grants or through the Medicaid waiver system.
Could I just one quickie follow up with Representative Hines?
Madam Chair. The cost, we were talking about closing Harborview, that since the cost of running institution was an important factor, what impact did that have on the city of Valdez? Was that ever looked at?
Madam Chair. There was a long, thoughtful planning process that was engaged in before the state made the decision to close the facility. And there were a number of factors that were taken into consideration. One was this facility was operated by state employees. So how could their employment be handled? Many of those employees found employment through community developmental disability programs. They were able to receive transfers to other departments in state government. Many of them chose not to stay in Valdez. I'm sure there was an economic impact to the city of Valdez. I think the state's consideration was correct in two ways. One, how best to serve people with developmental disabilities and their families. And I think the other was the cost of care in that facility was so great that we could do much more with those resources in the community.
Representative Seaton, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Assisted living homes, just before I came down here to Juneau, we were undergoing a crisis in Homer in that a number of the assisted living homes, and this was specifically for seniors, but that they were basically having to close their doors because they could not get insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And are you finding the same thing? Are the facilities that would function for the people that you're serving also having to close their doors because they can't get the required insurance?
Madam Chair? Well, I'd like to perhaps ask my associate, Dan Wigman, who's been working on a way that we could deal with that problem, have him explain as part of quality assurance, since he is also responsible for that unit that licenses assisted living homes. He may have a better answer than I do, but I would tell you that we have worked with Senior Services to develop a process where people could apply for an exception from that standard. And I think it'll be generally acceptable, and many assisted living homes will be able to continue in operation. Now, I would like to, assisted living licensing and assisted living homes provide a different function. We use in developmental disabilities the assisted living home licensing to set the standard for the quality of care in that kind of a home. We don't provide the operator in the developmental disability system with just the assisted living home rates. The rates are determined by the needs of the individual and their plan of care. So it's a little different than a senior system or the system that they use in mental health. It's just a distinguishing characteristic among these different groups of people.
Follow up, Rick.
Yes. But you would experience the same kind of criteria.
Yes.
I mean, loss of available
yes,
units if they couldn't get insurance.
So we have worked to try to reach a try to come into agreement with Wade, and while we can meet that requirement, still allow programs to continue. And I'm hoping I didn't put Dan on the spot too much by answering that question.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate the question.
Thank you very much, David, and maybe when the other two fellows get up there, they'll be able to clarify some of this, and it'll make more sense. Randall Burns, Director of API.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Burns. I'm the CEO at API. The mission at API is, and I'm going to read it just for the record, in partnership with patients, families, and their communities, API will provide appropriate quality individual treatment services that assist patients to achieve their goals and be successful in their communities. And that mission has changed over the years, and I think at this point is a very valid reflection of the work that we do with communities and patients and their families. API is the state's only hospital. We're a unique entity within state government. We have 74 beds. We're licensed for 90 to take into account over census concerns. For instance, today we have 77 patients in the hospital. Our patients are primarily indigent, and many of them are homeless. The criteria for admission to API is that one is a danger to oneself or to others, or is gravely disabled. And if an individual needing services does not meet that criteria, we attempt to work with communities and community mental health centers and finding alternative treatment within their community. Our patients can come from any community in the state. right now, 64% come from the Anchorage Bowl, and that's actually down from 75% 3 years ago. And actually, I was looking at the membership of this committee. 90% of our patients come from the regions that are represented on this committee. 30% of our patients are Alaska Native. 50% are Caucasian. The remaining 20% are a variety of other ethnicities. So our patients are obviously highly diverse, is one of the issues that we struggle with. A significant number of our patients also suffer from chemical dependence, whether it be substance abuse or alcohol abuse, or in many cases both. The majority of our patients are chronically mentally ill. We, of course, as a hospital, provide a wide range of medical and rehabilitative services, and we have a variety of clinical departments to provide those services. I think it's also important for you to know that a lot of the patients that are admitted to API suffer from significant medical problems as well. Many are diabetic, they have high blood pressure, they suffer from traumatic brain injuries, they use walkers, they use wheelchairs. We have a lot of patients with a lot of, besides their mental health issues, their medical issues as well. At API, we have 5 patient units. We have an adolescent unit that takes 13 to 17-year-olds. We do not take children under the age of 13. We have an adult admitting unit, which is 12 beds. We have an acute adult unit, which is 20 beds. We have a longer-term unit, also 20 beds. And then we have the secure adult or forensic unit, which is just 10 beds. I think that this packet was distributed out to you all that has, if you wouldn't mind looking 1 minute inside the strategic plan and going to page 7. This is a color copy. It's actually soon to be off the presses, as they say. But I wanted to draw your attention on page 7 to something that we always use an opportunity to share with legislators, and that is sort of the admissions and the resource issues. That chart at the bottom of that page, I think, says a lot about how well we've been able to function. Our admissions since 1992, basically 11 years ago, have increased 50%, and our funding and our staff are still below what we had in 1992. We take pride in the fact, particularly given what's going on with inflation in the medical field. On page 9, we also, API is funded through a combination of federal, state, and private insurance, the federal contribution to API in a program called Disproportionate Share Hospital, which means because we provide a disproportionate share of our care to indigent individuals, the federal government gives us funds for that purpose. And they actually, a few years ago, decided that they would cut that amount of money to all state hospitals across the country by 66%. So we were then challenged with having to make up that difference. And the chart at the bottom of page 9, one of the ways in which we made up that difference was increasing the amount of money that API itself collects. And we've really made an effort to do that. When they first decided to cut the DISH funds, we were collecting $2.3 million, and last year we collected $4.4 million. So we've worked very hard to maximize the amount of money that we can collect from a variety of payer sources. The other part that I want to talk about is the API Community Mental Health Project.
Randall?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Sure.
Could you, what kind of funds is it that you're collecting?
I mean, okay. We collect Medicaid for, I have to apologize for this. API is called an Institute for Mental Diseases under the federal guidelines, an IMD. And because of that, public hospitals can't actually collect Medicaid funds for their adults. And instead, then, the federal government created this disproportionate share hospital for public hospitals. And so that's a source of funds. But we can collect Medicaid for our adolescents. So one of the things we collect is Medicaid for our adolescent population. Some of our patients are on SSI or old enough to get Medicare, so we get Medicare. Some of our patients are VA eligible, and although they don't like to pay, sometimes they do. We also bill individual patients, and sometimes they have private insurance. And then we actually do bill patients. We're not a collection agency. We bill them, and then if they don't pay, we move on. So those are the sources.
Representative Wilson, for the record, and just one more question.
Sure.
Then trying to think of the right way to put this. There's been a more than double increase in your being able to collect funds.
Uh-huh.
Is it because you're diagnosing different, or what is the reason?
When we first started, we actually had more patients now, and so that's one thing. Number two, actually, I think, I guess the best way to say it is we weren't paying that much attention to collections. So we just really started putting a lot of attention on it. We really ratcheted up our UR function and made sure that for every patient that we thought we could collect from, we did. So mostly it was just really paying attention as the need for that grew. So we were doing that. And then the other reason we were actually able to do well is that the legislature has been kind enough to give us an increment even in the last year or two when most agencies were not getting increments. So that's all helped.
Thank you.
The Community Mental Health Project is, I'm sorry.
Representative Gatto has a question,
okay.
And then I have one more.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two short questions. One is the amount of money that you could collect,
mm-hmm.
that's eligible, not that, is some percent of what you actually collect some percent of that.
That's correct.
Are we talking a pretty low number?
Well, it depends on if it's an adolescent, we're very successful at maximizing the Medicaid dollars that we can collect from the payer. If they're an adult, chronically mentally ill adult with no resources, then no, we collect nothing for that.
Do you ever use a collection agency?
No, well, we have never done so.
Never.
No. Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the BIA or Indian Health Service, do they support, do they pay as well?
No, we do not bill for those services. We provide that service. What we do, though, both with other hospitals as well as, what, for instance, with the Alaska Native Medical Center, when our patients need care to be hospitalized or even for consults for their physical health needs, then we will, the patient is transported to that hospital, and they never bill us for the care of that patient. So in that sense, it's sort of works both ways. They cover those expenses when the individual's at that hospital.
Follow up, please.
Representative Seaton with a follow-up.
Yes. Is the patient status similar to that corrections has? I mean, a ward of the state? Is that the situation that we're in as far as billing?
Madam Chair? We have both involuntary and voluntary patients at API. The majority of our patients, I think about 74%, are involuntary on admission. And under some decision made in a local community, committed to the hospital. And in that sense, yes, they are given to the state. By statute, the state is responsible for providing that care for that individual.
Representative Hines, and I want the committee to just keep in mind that we have about 12 more minutes before this group is finished, and so we want to try to spread it out as much as we can. But Representative Hines.
Well, I don't want to interrupt your presentation, but I think something very important I'd like to talk to you about, and I'd like for all the folks out here also to hear this. So I can either do this now, or I can let him finish and then talk to him.
Well, why don't we finish then with the presentation so that we make sure that we have enough time.
Save me a couple minutes.
Well, I'll turn this over to Dan. I just wanted to briefly talk about the Community Mental Health Center, which was a project in Anchorage with primarily federal funds, $15 million, to create an emergency services system in Anchorage. That's been very successful in helping API keep its census down. And the primary thing in that is the psychiatric emergency room that has now started up at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. So.
But you're the director of API, right?
I am.
Okay. So I don't want you to go because you're the one I want to talk to.
That was Representative Hines talking. you go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
They just need to, the person back there needs to know who you are so that they can take notes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, in all these papers that we have, in all these numbers, I want to tell you something. A few years ago, there was a young man who was in need of some mental help. Okay, I got involved with this with the mental health caregivers. The young man was so ill that they said he needs to go to API. Then they told me the procedure of getting into API, and it was a very strong reaction to how that happened. They also briefed me on how you fib to API. First of all, you say that the person is homeless, that the person has no money, that, you know, you go through this litmus of things that you have to say. Otherwise, he goes in and comes right back out. And the only way that at that time you could get help to a person like this was to say he's homeless, he has no help, he has no family, he has no nothing. I was told this.
Representative, how long ago was this?
About 9 years.
Has it changed since then?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, but this is what?
I want to make sure we have enough time for the next gentleman to speak.
But I think this is also very, very important.
Do we have enough time for the next gentleman to speak?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
How long have you
been? Okay, I tell you what, I won't talk.
But we don't, it's not that we don't want to hear, but we don't want to spread this all out so that he doesn't get to speak.
I'd be happy to talk with you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
you, Madam Chair.
We might have time. Okay. Next up is Dan Wigman, Director of Quality Assurance of the Division.
Madam Chair, committee members, you've heard now from Leonard Abel about the mental health system and the services that system provides, and David Maltman about developmental disability services, and now just Randall about API. And I'm going to take just a couple of minutes to talk with you about the safety and quality assurance section of our division. That's whose job it is to monitor some specific small pieces of those systems that you heard about. You should have a PowerPoint handout that will look a little different. It's black in the back, and that's the top of this.
That's the next within your binder.
The safety and quality assurance section of our division has four components. One component is the assisted living home licensing investigation component, comprised of three certified licensing investigators. Second component is a utilization review piece that has one mental health professional that works in the single point of entry system that actually Randall had just minutes ago referred to, that has to do with the community system and keeping the admissions to API to referring folks to the proper points of care, including API, but ensuring people get to where they belong and monitoring that process. But the third component to the safety and quality assurance section is the quality assurance unit. And there are three mental health professional clinicians that work in that section. And then lastly, the Office of Integrated Housing, which is a newer piece that's we're doing in conjunction with the Division of Alcohol and Drug Abuse. So I'm just going to quickly, in each of those four areas, give you a little bit of information. The assisted living home licensing and investigation unit. First, the responsibility for adult assisted living homes in Alaska is shared with the Department of Administration through their Division of Senior Services for seniors in the assisted living home area, and with Department of Health and Social Services through our division for those who experience mental health related disabilities or developmental disabilities. Then the functions that the assisted living home licensing unit actually address, they're providing, first I want to make it clear that they're providing homes for the people that our mental health system and our developmental disability system serves pretty exclusively. And the policy framework for the assisted living home system that we're involved with is AS 4733, and the assisted living home regulation 7AAC 75. The assisted living home licensing unit's responsible for licensing and monitoring the compliance with that policy framework for right now 202 homes as of today's count, which equates to monitoring the overall safety of homes for about 700 people with disabilities. During FY02, the unit licensed or renewed licenses on those 200 homes, as well as having conducted 46 investigations of alleged low-quality care in some form. So they stayed pretty busy for 3 folks. I don't know if right now would be a good time, before I leave the assisted living home piece, Representative Seaton, to address your earlier.
Representative Seaton,
I'd sure appreciate it. Do you need the question repeated, or
would you?
Yes. The problem of, at least I know within the senior community, is that the homes are not able to get insurance, cannot find insurance carriers within Alaska to write the insurance, and therefore the either people are kind of cheating and using homeowners insurance, which wouldn't cover any of the liability, or they're going out of business and those homes are closing. And if you figured out a way to get around this, I'd sure appreciate knowing about it for my constituents.
Madam Chair, Representative Seaton. Well, I wish I could give you a short answer that was positive. The best I can say is we've been working on it, and we're continuing to work on it. Progress to date is that we've developed with the Division of Senior Services over in that department a process of that gives us an ability to waive some of those regulatory requirements related to insurance for certain types of homes, the ones that would be impacted the very most by the insurance crisis. And what's happened has been that insurance carriers have across the nation have simply found insuring these kinds of homes not to their liking and have withdrawn from providing insurance, which leaves very few carriers, and naturally the rates have gone way high because it's a market that's pretty available. And it impacts the homes with the smallest number of residents first. Those who serve 16 or 18 or 20 people receive enough funding, you know, across that many folks to be able to help defray some of that. So we focused on developing a waiver process for those homes with less than 6 residents in it, and they can apply for a waiver if they can submit sufficient information to convince our two divisions, or whichever division licenses that particular home, that they in fact A, cannot actually find an insurance carrier, it's simply not available, or B, the insurance is available, but the high cost of that insurance simply prohibits them staying in business. And the application process will involve a financial statement and so forth that will then waive that requirement. We did a survey a few months ago regarding this issue and found that most states, I don't have the actual numbers at this moment, but most states don't require with their regulations this the insurance that the way Alaska does. And those who do are experiencing the same kinds of problems that we're experiencing. So this, does that come close to answering your question?
Sure. Madam Chair, I would just So the way of solving is just to waive it. It's not to find a pool or any.
Well, there,
we haven't been able to at this point. Is that right?
Sure. We actually yesterday, you may have seen an article in the money section of the Anchorage Daily News, I believe this morning, that talks about a lunch that occurred with some of the assisted living home operators and some other folks related to that system, and they're beginning to talk about some sort of a pooling process.
Good.
Thank you. Just moving along, I know time's growing very short. The utilization review piece, I'll just very quickly say we have one mental health professional who is located at Providence Psychiatric Emergency Room that does case reviews, watches the every intake and case process as they come into the emergency services system and are referred out to either the psychiatric inpatient unit at Providence or API or Clitheroe's emergency detox unit or South Central Counseling Center's crisis treatment center, and feed back clinical and other information back into the policy development level for system refinement and so forth. The quality assurance unit portion of the a larger section actually was established in 1995 through an agreement with the Division of Medical Assistance with the primary purpose of increasing accountability and to assist in cost containment as it relates to how our community outpatient providers access Medicaid funds. And it actually has, this quality assurance unit has two functions. I have three mental health professionals currently that staff that unit. And they go out on site doing post-payment reviews and medical record reviews, looking at the clinical picture, determining or ensuring that the services that have been provided through the treatment plans are medically necessary, that eligible people receive those services, that there's good compliance with the Medicaid regulations. And they also conduct a low-level spot check type billing audit to ensure that the Medicaid reimbursements that went for services that were billed were in fact delivered based on their clinical documentation. The second function of the QA unit is to measure consumer satisfaction in across the mental health, developmental disabilities, and infant learning program system. Infant learning program, of course, is over the Division of Public Health. And this is a process that we contract out that involves face-to-face interviews with consumers across the state to get their perspective on those systems and provide feedback that that the folks sitting behind me can use to enhance the system. And then finally, the Office of Integrated Housing, which is a new, relatively new piece that involves a mental health clinician in our division sitting nearly at the same desk with a social services program manager from the Division of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, focusing on those that common, that client consumer population that we have in common with co-occurring mental health and substance abuse disorders in relationship to the housing needs for those folks. So I think that concludes what I have to provide to you. Unless there are questions, I'd be happy to answer. And that actually is the includes the division.
Okay. And Representative Hines, would you like to? I think we've got about two more minutes. If you can
two
tell your story.
2 minutes. The end of the story for the question was, to make a long story short, this young man was my nephew. After we go through the litmus test and we put him in and we ask for the diagnosis and help and do all those things, they bought him a one-way ticket to Mexico. To New Mexico, excuse me. What I wanted to say, my point was, it was very important to me, is that we can sit here with papers and numbers and Medicaid and all this stuff, but in there, underneath, is a lot of times a young adult. I appreciate all the head shaking, and parents that I raised this young man. He was my nephew. It's a very heartbreaking story, but in all these beautiful words, where... Tell me how things have changed. Promise me things have changed. It was one of the most horrendous things I have ever gone through in my life. And from that, I'm sitting on this committee because of that. Because I said, if I can help some child, some parent, to never go through that again. I mean, can you imagine? He was diagnosed with, well, it doesn't matter. But anyway, to put him on a plane one way. So that was it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate that, Representative Hines. And I think we have at API have worked very hard in the last 8 years to change the way in which we do business. We have a stable medical staff. We've had the same doctors. There used to be rotating locum tenens physicians who'd stay 3 months and leave. We have stable counselors, stable psychologists and social workers, the treatment teams. We've worked very hard to improve the treatment that patients at API receive. We still have complaints about the fact that patients aren't able to stay at API as long as some of the providers would like to see because of the pressures on us to discharge. But we're even working on that because of Providence and the Psych ER now. We never discharge people or give them a one-way ticket out of town. Oregon does that to us, but we don't do that anymore. We work very, very hard with families and with patients to make sure that the discharge plan that is adopted is one that the family and the patient are in agreement with, and if there's a community mental health center, that the case managers are involved as well.
Thank you.
That's good news that that we have had improvement over the years, and we hope that continues. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming. I appreciate it. And for our second half of our program, is there's an overview from the Mental Health Trust Authority.
You might take a 5-minute recess.
You can. It's not. It's
we
not.
We can take. Go ahead and just do what you have to do.
How are you doing?
Just go ahead and go, but see what happens.
Oh, as usual.
We don't have. Okay, we need to get going. We're kind of running behind, and I don't want to cut these gentlemen off in the middle of their presentation. So we have Phil Yonkers, who is the trustee chair of the Mental Health Trust Authority, Nelson Page, who is the trustee of the chair and chair of the Budget Committee, and Jeff Jesse, who is executive director of the Mental Health Trust. And I'll let you gentlemen introduce yourselves as you speak, and we'll listen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I am Phil Yonker, senior chairman of the trust. Before we start today, we have all the trustees in Juneau this week, and I'd like to introduce Karen Robinson and Susan LaBelle, if they could stand. John Pugh, John Malone, and Tom Hawkins. So that makes up the trustees. We also have with us today Steve Planchett, who runs our trust land office and is a very intricate part of what the trust does. We're going to break this into sort of three parts today. And first, we really appreciate your time and the opportunity to get to come before you.
For the committee, it's under page two of our binder.
And I might add, we don't stay on script very well sometimes. So Jeff's going to give you some history of how the trust was created. And let me just say that Alaska is very unique in having a trust. And the trust is very unique in its relationship with the state administration, with the legislature, and how it deals with the beneficiaries in Alaska. So it's a very unique opportunity to serve on this, and each trustee, I think, would tell you that it's really a valuable time in their life to have been able to do that. With that, I'm going to let Jeff give you a little history of the trust, and then Nelson's going to give you a little bit about our programs, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our land division.
Well, for some of you, you've heard this story many times, and I apologize for that, but we do have some new members of the committee, so I thought it would be helpful if we kind of went back and got a running start on this. In the beginning, when we were a territory, Alaska had what can only be described as a barbaric mental health system. If you had any kind of a mental disability, it didn't matter if you were mentally ill, mentally retarded, a chronic alcoholic, you had Alzheimer's, if you had a mental disability and you couldn't make it, and with whatever supports you had, which basically was your family, maybe the church, maybe a neighbor, and you came to the attention of the territorial officials, You were tried and convicted of a territorial crime of being an insane person at large. You didn't have to have done anything. Just had a mental disability and come to the attention of the feds. And they put you on an airplane, and a federal marshal would fly you down to Morningside Hospital in Oregon, where you would serve a life sentence at the federal expense, because we were a territory. When statehood was being discussed, people forget this became a big deal, because the new state would have to take over this financial responsibility to pay for Morningside, let alone to develop some kind of mental health system within the new state of Alaska. And it actually held up statehood. And one of the problems was the new state had no visible means of support. The federal government owned 98% of all the land. So how are we going to generate any money to pay for a mental health program? Well, it took them a couple of years to figure this out, and they came up with a three-pronged strategy. The first was a chunk of money that built the original wing of API and bought the motel in Valdez that was the original Harborview Developmental Center. The second part was we got some federal money that went down a little bit every year over about 8 years to pay for the operation of these facilities, but it kept going down so that we weaned off of the federal dole. The third part was, well, for the long-term funding, why don't we take a page out of the university land trust and the school land trust, and we'll let the new state pick 1 million acres of land to hold in trust, generate income to pay for these mental health services. Well, the state did a great job picking this land. I mean, Homer Spit, Kenai River frontage, big timber around Haines, the Beluga coal field. In Southeast, they look like donuts around every community, and the theory was great. As Alaska grew, our mental health needs would increase, the land would become more valuable, and make more money, we'd pay for these services. Now, we didn't know about Prudhoe Bay. A couple hundred acres in Prudhoe Bay, and we'd have a heck of a mental health program. But they picked really good land. But, gee, they got 100 million acres of general state lands with statehood, and they just kind of lumped all the land together. And over the next 25 years, the most valuable 500,000 acres of that million got taken out of the trust in various ways. In Haines, we took those big pumpkins, and we turned them into eagle roosts, and we created the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. We gave less than market value coal leases. All the land lotteries and homesteads and agricultural projects, 5,000 individual Alaskans ended up with pieces of mental health trust land. We used to call them the moms and the pops. Part of the Chugach State Forest was original trust land. Well, it all started to come undone when the local governments got the right to select state land like the state had selected land from the feds. And not surprisingly, when you think about where the mental health trust land was, they disproportionately selected mental health trust land. Well, their lawyers went down and looked at the title and said, oh man, you're in trouble. You're not paying anything for this land. You're on notice in the record of title that it's trust land. You have a cloud on your title. So what would you do? Well, they went to the legislature in 1979 and said, fix this. And the legislature said, sure, no problem. They passed the law. They said all this mental health trust land is now general state land. Now, of course, they had lawyers, and their lawyers said, well, you're going to have to pay for this land because you're a trustee. So they set up a bank account, and they were going to put money into this to pay for the land. But they never remembered to make any deposits. Well, it only took the mental health people about 3 years to figure out there was something wrong with this. And they ended up with a lawyer in Fairbanks that was willing to file a lawsuit, and Steve Cooper filed the original Mental Health Lands Trust suit. Now, I have to say, Governor Cooper had a great history. He was a member of the legislature that voted to steal the land. He was the lawyer that filed the suit to get it back, and as governor, he presided over 2 failed settlement attempts. It doesn't get any better than that. So, we have this big problem. The Alaska Supreme Court in 1985 makes the obvious ruling, which is, hey, you can't do this state. You were trustees. You took this land. You can't do this. Give it back. Oh, no. They don't have it to give back. All these people have done stuff with it. You can't just throw the eagles out of the tree. And so we set on this decade-long settlement process that went through permutation after permutation. And to kind of cut down to, well, how did we finally get it settled? Well, first of all, the settlement proceeded in two different pieces. One we call the program side, and that's how we all got created. And the other is the asset side. Well, first let's talk about the assets. Everybody loves to talk about the assets. Well, we had 500,000 acres left of the original million, so we got that back. We pulled all the stakeholders, the coal miners, the resource developers, the municipalities, the greenies. I mean, we had everybody in the room. We used to call it the Unholy Alliance. And we settled on a definite land list of replacement land that together with the original 500,000 would bring us up to 1,000,000 acres. Now, that wasn't going to make us whole because we lost the most valuable half. So we settled on $200 million as a cash payment. Now, that still didn't quite make us whole, but we wanted something more important even than the assets, and that was a way to make the trust work for the beneficiaries. No offense, but one of the big problems with the original trust is that our trustee was the legislature. And you have a very important public trust responsibility of the whole state. It's hard to hand out baseball caps that say trustee, and suddenly you're going to have a special relationship with a limited group of Alaskans over a limited set of assets. So we want an independent trustee that could oversee the management of the assets and, most importantly, spend the proceeds for the benefit of the beneficiary without a legislative appropriation. That was the hardest piece to get, because that's why you're here, spending the money. So, now, of course, the legislature and the governor at the time weren't going to just hand over all these assets to seven trustees, as illustrious though they be. So what they said is, look, for the land, we don't want this taken totally out of the state's overall land management structure. So we want to have a separate land office within the Department of Natural Resources that would generally follow the state land management principle, except for this critical aspect. To the extent that they are incompatible with the trust's undivided duty of loyalty to the beneficiaries, they don't apply. That's why we get in trouble when we won't give special deals to a school district, or we won't give a special deal to somebody else, or we sell round logs at a high profit instead of putting them all into value-added industries for a small profit, because we have to maximize the return for the beneficiaries. Now, on the $200 million, they certainly didn't want us handling that, so that is managed by the permanent fund. We're part of the total permanent fund package, like a mutual fund. We pay our share of the cost, we pay our share of the profit, or more recently, the loss. So that's kind of how that part was formed. Well, now how do the trustees then use the resources from that in order to help the mental health program? Well, we'll talk a little bit more in a few minutes how the trust is financially set up. But basically, we operate not unlike a foundation. We pay out a percentage of our total asset value every year, plus the income earned from the land. And that's what we use to try to help you create a comprehensive, integrated mental health program for the state. Now, if you look at the second page, you'll see who our trust beneficiaries are. And again, this is going right back to the settlement. In fact, during the settlement process, one of the little wrinkles was that the attorneys representing the mentally ill made the argument that only the mentally ill were left in the trust. that the state over the years had removed all the other groups from the trust. When you sent senior services over to administration, you took the people with Alzheimer's out of the trust. When you created a separate division of alcohol and drug abuse, you took the alcoholics out of the trust. Well, this is circle the wagons and shoot inward. So we ended up having to go to the judge and say, okay, you have to tell us who are the beneficiaries of this trust. And that's why when the judge made this decision and said, look, it's all the people that went to Morningside. That's why the federal government set up the trust. You'll see in the statute there are some terms used by the judge that aren't really politically correct. For example, the judge talked about the mentally retarded and defective. We don't talk about defective anymore. Now we talk about developmental disabilities. Chronic alcoholics with psychosis. Well, that's an odd use of the modifier psychosis. So we've had to try to work with the judge's definitions to try to get something that works within a more modern kind of formulation of these things. One of the ways that the judge delineated the beneficiaries, though, was to say, well, look, the state can add beneficiaries to the trust. You just can't reduce it below this group of four core beneficiaries, which is why you'll see on the next page one of the groups that we think are beneficiaries are people with traumatic brain injuries. They walk like beneficiaries, they talk like beneficiaries, they have the same functional problems as beneficiaries. And Alaska produces a large number of traumatic brain injuries because of our industry, because of our lifestyle. We do produce a lot of these, but often they have gotten lost in the shuffle as people have said, well, they're not really mental health. Well, they're not really developmental disabilities. Well, they're not really dementia. And so we're taking some ownership and working with our advisory boards to try to bring some attention to the services that these people need. So unless you have any questions about sort of the basic structure formation of the trust, I'll let Phil start on the resource end of things.
Thank you, Jeff. As Jeff said, the trust really ended up with two assets. One was $200 million, and by the settlement, it's made a deposit into the Alaska Permanent Fund, and they manage it. The other was approximately 1 million acres, actually 994,000 acres that we finally ended up with. Of that, 547,000 was fee estate, which means we can sell, we own simple fee title to. It was 435,000 of the original, and then we substituted or replaced the 112,000. And one of the things that Jeff didn't tell you that when the original 1 million acres with all these donuts around all your communities was assessed or appraised, it was $2.2 billion back then. And so we ended up then with a mineral estate of about 341,000. 56 was the original, 285,000 was substituted for those that had been used or taken. One of the pieces of mineral lands that gets at least some notice of ours is Fort Knox Gold Mine in Fairbanks, which produces 1,000 ounces of gold every day. We don't get any of that, but we do lease the land the facility's set on. We've enhanced that a couple of times. And then coal, oil, and gas, and we've recently did some oil and gas leases, the Kenai Peninsula, and we're getting ready to do some more. The revenue from the land really goes in two directions. If it's income that's not a non-renewable portion, it goes in and is spent the year that it's earned. And so we have lease rents or those types of things. If it's an asset that is a non-renewable resource, it goes into the principal and it cannot be spent. Now, in some cases, we're finding that you have to have a mix there. For example, in timber, we deposit 85% of the sale of a timber sale into the principal, and we spend 15% because at some point the trees will grow back and we can use it again. If we sell gravel, for example, 100% of it goes into the principal, and we don't spend any of that. The the land office, to me, and I want to share this with you, and I don't know if Steve Blanchett was responsible to this staff, but each land office employee carries a business card. And on the back of it says the Trust Land Management's guiding principles. Be loyal and accountable to the trust and its beneficiaries. Maximize the long-term revenue from the land, the trust land. Protect and enhance the value of trust land. Manage trust land prudently and efficiently. Encourage the diversity of the revenue-producing uses of the trust land. And emphasize innovative solutions. I think they live up to that tremendously. They have grown, as you'll notice in the next chart, to and these gives you the revenue, and I just want you to look at the yellow lines as you go up the revenue, or yours is black and white, maybe mine's yellow, the posts in the graph. We try to develop income off of the lands that is a sustainable income, and we try to manage the trust always with a sustainable income, and that's because we're putting money in to match or to fund programs. Most of our programs are 3 to 5 years that we look at before we try to take them off of trust money and transfer them to your general fund, mental health, or someplace else. And so we have to sort of be careful that we don't fund programs this year and then not have money next year to refund those programs. The Science and Tech Foundation, for example, had no money to pay out last year. We'd have some awfully unhappy beneficiaries and probably legislators if we said to you, well, we're not putting any money in the pot this year. And so a young man designed and built the model of this trust where it's almost guaranteed that it'll always make a level payout. We pay out 3.5% of the net asset value of the trust plus the land income that's income and doesn't have to go back into the principal. With that, we've increased the income every year. And to give you an idea of how efficient I think our land department is, if you look at Alaska Business Monthly, at the top 49 employers and what their revenue is by employee, we have 9 employees. We rank 6th in the state. And per employee, we produce $856,000 with 9 employees, managing 1 million acres of land and assets and resources. So they're very, very efficient. From 1996, when we got started in this, we had produced about $6.8 million in revenue from the land. Some of that went back to principal, some was income. We had $230 million in total assets at that time. We paid out 3%. By 2002, the land office contributed $10 million, almost $11 million, and we had almost $303 million in assets. And so we've been able to grow the trust in a way that the model said that we'd be able to, and to continue the payouts. Our trust is designed that we hold, and just in a graphic thing, if you had a barrel here that held the principal, we have a bucket up above it that we retain 400% of this year's payout in that bucket. And when we get more than that in it, it flows down to the barrel underneath. And so we always have assets that's not locked up in the principal that we can use to fund our beneficiary needs. We have experienced, and the model was built on 60 years of history of the stock market. We have experienced, of course, 9/11, and then crooked accounting, now the war, and 3 years of recession. And we met our payout this year. We have funds in the principal reserve that will meet them at least 2 more years. And we've now taken a step that we have moved a part of that money into a less risky investment out of the permanent fund into the Department of Revenue because we needed to get away of some of the risk because the permanent fund invests only on one risk model, and that's a long-term risk model, and we know we're going to need these funds in the next 2 years. And so we made some changes. We've also adopted a new policy that when we, if our principal reserve gets down to less than 200%, 2 years payout, the trustees automatically will adjust to 3.5% down to 3.25% in order to give us that cushion and know that we can always serve our beneficiaries in an ongoing basis with a level payout. And with that, I'm going to stop, and Nelson's going to give you a little bit about our programming and what we really do.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the philosophy that we use in terms of what it is that we do, how it is that we come up with recommendations for you and for the legislature, and then we'll go into some specific areas. And as I talk about these things, I wanted to comment, Representative Hines, that your comments about the need for change sort of warmed the cockles of our heart.
Thank you.
Because that is exactly what the trust is all about. We consider ourselves to be a catalyst for change in the system. The kinds of things that you described, the kinds of horror stories that all of us who've worked in this field can unfortunately recount to all too many of, are the sorts of things that the trust exists to do away with, to make things better. And so the philosophy that we have in terms of the use of these assets that we have and the money that we generate is to use those things to work for system change. Now, there's one other aspect of that, and that is that we understood very early on that if we simply started paying the bills and started paying for business as usual, in other words, if we simply let the money that we generate be folded into the state's budget as part of the state's present programs, pretty quickly all of our ability to make decisions and to make changes would go away, because we wouldn't have any more money. We'd be just keeping the lights on for the present system. So what we have done with the trust, the approach the trust has taken has been to work in conjunction with the legislature and in conjunction with the four advisory boards they'll talk about again in a second, to look for places where the system needs to be moved in a different direction. And then we put our assets into making it easier for the system to move in those directions. I'll talk about the mechanics, and then I'll give you some specific, specific examples. One of the trust's responsibilities is to recommend to the governor and to the legislature each year a single appropriation bill that covers all of the appropriations for what's called the mental health program. And that is, and so we, in conjunction with the four advisory boards, that's the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities and Special Education, the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, and the Alaska Commission on Aging, start the process by asking those four advisory boards, the Department of Health and Social Services, and others, to come to us with recommendations. Where is the system not working? Where is the system most in need of change? What are the new ideas that we can come up with that will make the system work smarter? That is not unlike the way the legislature looks, makes its budgets every year. We ask those who are on the ground in the community serving these needs to come to us and tell us, what do you have to have? What's most important? There are two elements of that budget recommendation. First, we ask for recommendations about how trust money should be spent. And secondly, we ask for recommendations about how the state's money should be spent. And if you look at our budget documents, you'll see that there are really two different categories. One is called MTAR, Mental Health Trust Authorized Receipts, and that's our money. And the second is GFMH, General Fund Mental Health, and that is the state's money that goes through the single appropriation that's required by the settlement. We aren't required, as Jeff said, to spend trust money through the legislature's budget process. But for the most part, we prefer to do it that way because it gives us an opportunity to work with you and, frankly, to incentivize. If we think there is something that should happen, it's much more effective for us to come to you and say, we'd like to partner with you. And I'll talk about some of the examples that we've been able to partner with you in the last few years. Having made those recommendations, we compare them to our comprehensive plan. And this is the other element of our budget process that I'm very proud of. According to the settlement, we are required, along with the Department of Health and Social Services, to create a comprehensive integrated mental health plan for the state of Alaska. That was done. It is being, it's worked on a continual basis, and it's updated on a continual basis. We are what I like to call early adopters of the idea that there should be clear, defined goals and objectives. We like to have outcomes that are specified, and our comprehensive mental health plan is built along those lines. There are specific areas, and you can see them in the slide that's called results-based planning areas, that we want the state and the budget to address. Areas for our beneficiaries of health, safety, economic security, and living with dignity. Under that plan, there are measurable things that we want to affect. Just to take an example, under health, there is a part of our plan that talks about a desire to improve early health for our beneficiaries. So we want to know, for example, is the number of premature births going down? Because that's one of the primary causes or indicators for developmental disability. Are the number of fetal alcohol syndrome children, babies being born, is that being affected by our program? How many mothers are reporting, for example, that they used alcohol during pregnancy? Because that's another indicator. It's information we already gather, and it's information that will tell us whether our program is somehow going to make a difference. So we gather up our budget recommendations. We look at those and ask how they meet the objectives of the plan. And that's how we come up with our recommendations that go to the governor and the legislature each year. Now, a lot of we use a number of tactics or strategies, and I'd like to talk about some of those in terms of making our recommendations and in terms of coming up with our plan. What we've tried to do is make sure that the things we do will actually impact the system and make it work smarter. And that means sometimes doing things differently, sometimes doing away with things. There have been occasions, for example, where we have found that programs have not been doing what we asked them to do.
What's happening?